Welcome back to another episode of Still Waters. Name's Andre, and we're about to finish Luke, and we are on chapter 21. As Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow put in two very small copper coins. "Truly, I tell you," he said, "this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she lived out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on." Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down." "Teacher," they asked, "when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" He replied, "Watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name, claiming I am he, and the time is near. Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and uprisings, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Then he said to them, "Nations will rise against nation, and the kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, pestilence in various places, and fearful events, and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will seize you and persecute you. They will hand you over to synagogues and put you in prison, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. And so you will bear testimony to me. But make up your minds not to worry before how you will defend yourselves, for I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You will be betrayed by parents, brothers and sisters, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. Everyone will hate you because of me. But not a hair of your head will perish. Stand firm, and you will win life. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the cities get out. Let those in the country not enter the city, for this is the time of punishment and fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled over by Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexities at the roaring and tossings of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with a power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. He told them in this parable, "Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they sprout leaves, you can see for yourselves and know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will never pass away. Be careful, or your hearts will be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, and the anxieties of life. And that day will be close on you, suddenly, like a trap. For it will come on all those who live on the face to the whole earth. Be always on the watch and pray that you may be able to escape all that is about to happen, and that you may be able to stand before the Son of Man." Each day Jesus was teaching at the temple, and each evening he went out to spend the night on the hill called the Mount of Olives, and all the people came early in the morning to hear him at the temple. I want to go back before I get to chapter 22. I'm sure you've heard sermons on this, but I might as well reiterate. So in chapter 21, it talks about the two copper coins that the word put in was more than was wealth. Everyone else's wealth. So I'm sure you've already discerned, but obviously we don't go by quantity, we go by quality per individual. There's other institutions. I'm sure people would appreciate a $1,000 donation, offering, tithe. But it seems it's on the basis of what the individual is. So if I have 1,000,000 shekels, I give 1,000, it's not really saying much. But if I give 1,000 and all I had was 1,000, now that says something. You literally gave all you had. Now, I think the other temptation people like to take is we use these verses to pressure each other, right? Hey, you should do this, like this lady did. At the end of the day, there's another verse that Paul goes into later in the New Testament, and he basically says, don't be pressured, do it cheerfully, and do it because you want to, not because you were pressured to, right? So there seems to be a heart posture and tithing and donation that needs to be expressed. Otherwise, if you just keep shaming people to take action, you've already lost in the long run. But we'll get into that later, probably in a later podcast. But just wanted you to know that it's really easy to take one verse and use it as the main fulcrum point to get people to do certain things, when in reality, you need to take it all into consideration. Discernment. The next one in verse 5 in chapter 21, they're talking about, and verse 6, but Jesus said, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Now he's doing his prophecy thing. And essentially this happens in Titus, all right? The Jews start doing their thing. They start getting a little rabble-rousy. I'm giving you the layman terms for it, the cliff notes. And basically the temple, Herod's temple, gets destroyed, right? The city gets surrounded, Jerusalem, and it just gets besieged, and Rome just wipes them off. And the temple, you know, you'll notice it says some of the disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. Okay, so this temple is pretty elaborate. You look at the pictures, there's like gold. So essentially the cement, or the what's holding the bricks together, you can call it the filler or the, I don't know, the glue that's holding the temple together, but it was mostly, people say it was gold. So when some guy threw fire in the temple, the gold was melting. So people realized, oh snap, let's, you know, we remove the stones, you can get the gold, and you're pretty much, it was payday, early retirement for some people. Hence why you might hear that term. It says, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. And you'll look at the temple now, and it's all ripped apart. All the stones are toppled over each other because, well, someone wants the gold. That's what the story says. I just want you to know that the purpose of these parables, these prophecies, it's not a parable, the prophecy is that you should have confidence in what this guy is saying. Even when it didn't make sense, it came to pass. And I'm not sure what the exact percentages or the exact amount of prophecies. Maybe someone could say in the comments or reiterate it, correct me by all means, but it's about 400 of them. Some argue less, some argue more, but Jesus done like about 80% of them. So if he's already done 80% of them, chances are he's going to finish up with the other 20. So there's that. Let's get into chapter 22 now of Luke. Now the festival of unleavened bread, called the Passover, was approaching, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some way to get rid of Jesus, for they were afraid of the people. Then Satan entered Judas, called Iscariot, one of the 12, and Judas went to the chief priests and the officers of the temple guard and discussed with them how he might betray Jesus. They were delighted and agreed to give him money. He consented and watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over to them when no crowd was present. Interesting. Interesting. The people love this guy. Then came the day of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover. Where do you want us to prepare for it? They asked. He replied, as you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the home. The teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there. They left and found these things just as Jesus had told them, so they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God. After the cup, he gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread and gave thanks and broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this is the cup. This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. But the hand of him who is going to betray me is with mine on the table. The Son of Man will go as it has been decreed. But woe to that man who betrays him. They began to question among themselves which of them it might have, who might be who would do this. A dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. The one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? It is not the one who is at the table, but I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom just as my Father confers on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to shift you, all of you, has asked to shift all of you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brother. But he replied, Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. And Jesus answered, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me. Then Jesus asked them, when I sent you without purses, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. He said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. If you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. Disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. That's enough, he replied. Jesus went out as usual. As usual, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, pray that you will not fall into temptation. He withdrew about a stone thrown beyond them, knelt down and prayed, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. And an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. When he arose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. Why are you sleeping? He asked. Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. While he was speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? What happened? When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? One of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answers, no more of this. And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the countryside and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. The servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, "This man was with him," but he denied it. "Woman, I do not know him." A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." "I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean." Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." For just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the words the Lord had spoken to him, "For the rooster crows that day, you will disown me 3 times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. I think what gets me about that verse is how it says he wept bitterly. Yeesh. That's rough, man. But we'll get to that later. Let us continue on. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And then they said many other insulting things to him. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Messiah," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" He replied, "You say that I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips." Luke chapter 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be the Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirred up the people all over Judea by his teachings. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was in Jerusalem at the time. He just happened to be there. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He piled him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they were enemies. I got the two things that strike me in this text is how they were enemies and now they're friends. You'd be surprised how people can come together if there is a common enemy or cause. I think the other thing that I find interesting is it says he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. He didn't impose it. Didn't he say give to Caesar what is Caesar? He didn't impose it. I think what I want to encourage you with is this. You can heal people. You can help blind people see. You can help crippled people walk. You can help leprosy. And you would think with all that, people would like you. Well, guess what? Verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis of your charge against him. Neither has Herod, for he has sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man, release Barabbas to us." Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with a loud shout, they insisted, demanding that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who has been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, and the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children, for the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and on the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" I think one translation in King James says, "When people do evil while it is still green on the trees, what will happen when things are dry?" That gives you indication. If you thought things were bad before, that ain't nothing. Verse 32, two other men, both criminals, were also led with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divide up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is God, Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are king of the Jews, save yourself." Now, that wine vinegar, if I'm not mistaken, it's supposed to be like a painkiller, but I digress. Verse 38, there was a written notice above him which read, "This is King of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminals rebuked him. "Don't you fear God?" he said. "Since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." I need to pause right here. I've noticed there's been a lot of discussion over this moment right here about salvation and baptism and a lot of ink being spilled. I have seen two dichotomous extremes. The first one, some people would bet the farm that this statement doesn't apply to us because, you know, we're not on a cross and this only applies to him. Some would say, look how Jesus told him and he was saved. What does it mean for you? This is what I believe. Andre's allegory time. I would say, what he's going to talk to you about, he's going to talk to you about. That may not be an answer you want to hear, a standard, but I believe God has a way of holding us accountable to the standard he has set on us. That is to say that if you happen to be on a cross and you can't baptize, but you're willing to repent and ask for forgiveness, by all means. My mentality is, what's stopping you? Because if we play a game called, hey, look at this and look at that, when you ought to be doing, look at yourself. Because that's what the standard you'd be held to. It is interesting to note how the Bible kind of over and over again keeps insinuating this. There is a standard, but it seems like he takes into account every individual. What they know, what they don't know, what they do, what they didn't do, etc. The Bible has a way of treating every single person in an idiosyncratic way. I believe the human mind and ego is conditioned in such a way that, especially in our world, in the Western culture, do's and don'ts. But you can hear how Jesus talks. He says, if you have hatred in your heart with somebody, you've already committed murder. Well, that's interesting. There's no law in America that says if you got an attitude with somebody, you've committed murder. That's bizarre. And yet he has the temerity, the audacity, to make such a statement. So it makes you wonder, if the heart posture is like that, then we really need to reflect on where our hearts are at. That's not a fun statement. I want to tell you, as long as you don't cross those lines, you're in. But that's not the case. Anywho. Verse 44. It was now about noon, and the darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. The sun stopped shining, and the curtains of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When he had said this, he breathed his last. I want you to note something. Most people died on the whipping post. And the fact that he says this phrase, then he dies, indicates to me that as long as he kept talking, he can't die. I know it sounds weird, but here's my point. He literally says in other passages that no man takes my life lest I lay it down. And this is interesting because he also says I could summon 12 legions of angels. So Jesus is clearly in control of the situation. He's just choosing to lay down his life for the salvation of humanity. And this language is very interesting. You could always look at the cross as the greatest tragedy and you feel sad for Jesus. Or you could also see it as this, the level of self-control this man has when he has the power. See, it's one thing if I get executed, right? It's sad because, you know, Andre was unjustly executed. And there's one aspect of that. However, if you knew I had the launch sequence codes for a nuclear bomb and I could just press the button and destroy all the people who got me killed, brutally murdered, I could just destroy all of them, but I choose not to press it. What does that say about me? Something to reflect on in regards to character and power. Because if you didn't have any power, it wouldn't really matter. There's a phrase saying that the meek shall inherit the earth. Meek means a man with a sword sheath. It also means self-control, which indicates to me this guy has the power, but he's choosing not to exercise it. Not yet, anyway. The story suggests he's going to return. Grace and mercy, man. Verse 47. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, surely this was a righteous man. When all the people who had gathered to witness this sign saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. Including the women. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man, who had not consented to their decision and actions. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea, and he himself was waiting for the kingdom of God. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen cloth, and placed it in the tomb cut in the rock, one in which no one had yet been laid. It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. The women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and saw the tomb, how his body was laid in. Then they went home and prepared spices and perfumes, and they rested on the Sabbath in obedience to the command. Yeah, the Sabbath, man, every Saturday. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of the sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be rise again." Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. Now, that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened, and they talked and discussed these things with each other. Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deeds before God and all the people. The chief priests and the rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But he had hope that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is a third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us what they had seen, a vision of angels who said he was alive." Now, I think that's an interesting phrase. I got to pause right there. We say Jesus has been crucified. We say Jesus is dead. But notice how the angels refer it. Why do you go looking for the dead? He has risen. He is alive. That's a very interesting phrase, which literally means he conquered sin and death. His body, I guess, is gone. But that's a kind of a play on words. It's very hard to comprehend that. Probably want to soak in that phrase, because first of all, they can't find his body. He kind of did this as an epic foreshadowing, because we noticed stories like Moses and a few other characters. I think it was like Elijah. He did not know death. He just took him up to heaven. It's like, okay, I guess he didn't die. I don't even know what to make of that. Took Moses' body so Satan couldn't get it. Very interesting how the Bible alludes to the fact that these two major prophets didn't, you can't find their body. And now you have Jesus, you can't find his body either. But they showed you this dude got vehemently murdered, got straight up executed. And yet, this is the language the Bible uses with the angels. This is important because that means everything he said was true. Right? He's saying that if you put your faith in me, you will have everlasting life. And now here you go. This guy gets, clearly he died, but then he comes back. So there's that. I probably didn't say that as clever as I wanted to, but I want you to really reflect on how that angel refers to him in such a fashion. Then some of our, verse 24, Luke 24, verse 24. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it was just as the woman had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? In the beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Whoa, that right there was huge. Notice how Jesus just confirmed the Old Testament. The Old Testament just got confirmed. Because there's our people that say, why do we read the Old Testament? We can just read the New Testament. And yet right there, verse 27, in the beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in the scriptures concerning himself. That indicates to me all the Old Testament is just a epic foreshadowing of what was going to happen. But you gotta look for it. Verse 28, as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going farther, but they urged him strongly, stay with us, for it is nearly evening and the day is almost over. So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread and gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon. Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them and when he broke the bread. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, peace be with you. They were startled and frightened, thinking they saw a ghost. He said to them, why are you troubled? Why do you doubt? Why do doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have. Now, I got to pause right there. This is interesting. He noticed the language he just said. It said he stood among them. While they were talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them. I think one translation says he just appeared. They were startled and frightened, thinking they saw ghosts. This guy, he looks like him. He has human qualities. This is some like... This is beyond human comprehension. They can recognize it's him, but he's doing things that are beyond the parameters of a normal person, of a physical body. But you can still recognize his body. You also notice in the parable of Lazarus and the rich merchant, it says, I could see Abraham's bosom. That's interesting because, you know, people have a lot of descriptions about what heaven's like, our heavenly bodies and all that angel stuff. But clearly people could identify each other, despite their beyond the parameters of normal physicalities. So I just want you to notice that he has a physical body, but it's clearly not just a physical body. Verse 40. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and feet, and while they still did not believe it because of joy and amazement, he asked them, do you have anything here to eat? They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. Ain't that weird? He has the power to appear in a room and also eat fish. You can't make this. This is something else. And he said to them, this is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and Psalms. Whoa. That confirms it again. But then he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. Say what? He told them, this is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. And repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in the name in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. I am going to send you what my Father has promised. But stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high. The ascension of Jesus. So when he had led them out of the vicinity of Bethany, he lifted up his hands and blessed them. And while he was blessing them, he left them and was taken up into heaven. Then they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they stayed continually at the temple praising God. And that's the end of Luke. I want to focus on something here. I want to focus on 2 points and you can get on out of here. I think what I want to focus on now is the Judas agrees to betray Jesus. Now, I think what's unfortunate is a lot of people judge Judas, and we judge Peter, and we judge Thomas. When I say judge them, I say we look at their lives and usually use them as the catalysts of our statement, like, oh my gosh, if you were with Jesus, how could you ever do that? Now, not only is that super immature, it's also illogical. Imagine you live in a time, the context of people getting crucified on a daily basis. Imagine you were being oppressed by the Roman government and the prophecy foretold that some guy was going to show up and liberate your people and get things done. The biggest issue of life is not death. It is life itself. It is life. Because we ultimately want life to go a certain way. And this is what's happening in these stories. Judas wants Jesus to do what he thinks he ought to do, which is roll up his sleeves and fold the Roman Empire like a lawn chair. Now, Jesus does do that, but not in the way he expects. So I guess the real question is, do you trust God and how he's going to do it, not just how you think he ought to do it? Oh, man. You'd be shocked how many people wouldn't go to church if they knew they didn't get it their way, like it was Wendy's or McDonald's, where that expression was. I think it's really sad how often we usually pray when things don't go our way. We usually pray when things are bad, and that's normal. We usually pray when things are confusing. That's normal. But it's sad because it indicates to me that once the circumstances are more comfortable and conducive and you got what you want, you're probably not, watch this, talking anymore. The dialogue has ceased. Is the only thing that justifies your relationship with people is when you want something? Maybe that's why you got a low self-image and you're insecure, because really the truth of the matter is that's the basis of all your relationships. You only want something. And anytime you want something versus just being with something, that's why you're insecure. Think about it. If every relationship you have is on the basis of what can I get out of it, no wonder your mind is cracked, because your brain is thinking, well, that's how I treat everyone, therefore that's how everyone's going to treat me. Look, Judas wanted Jesus to take out Rome. Peter wanted Jesus to make things be smooth. Thomas wanted Jesus to make things be smooth. They all wanted different renditions. And any time the desire is greater than the destination, the journey, the path, the experience, you ultimately will end up like these men. So instead of judging and saying, I would never be like them, the truth of the matter is we already are. At some point, some way, whether we are cognizant of the fact or not. So my prayer, my question, my reflection to you would be, if you got everything you wanted, would you still pray? Would you still serve? Would you still be involved? Would you still go to church? Would you still worship? Would you still have the fruits of the Spirit and treat other people with dignity and respect? That is the question. That is the test we all must make. And if your only intentions of following Christ is when it's conducive and it suits your will and your evil intent, then you've already missed the point and you've already fall victim like these three men. Sometimes the best thing you can do is serve without even having an agenda, without even having an answer. And in a way, you come about to the real answer. Well, that's enough philosophy for one night. Hopefully that stirs something in your mind. And once you get your thoughts right and your intentions and heart right, You're far more aligned with God's will than most people realize for themselves. And with that, ends my time with you. And I pray that even if you don't have the answer, you're one step closer. That's better than not taking a step at all, eh? With that, I'll talk to you later. You have a blessed day. Deuces.